I'll say it like this time. We had our chance for reform, and that was Barack Obama. And that was the last chance for reform. Now, Occupy Wall Street, this is a revolution. Woo. Whether we know it or not, this is a revolution. Because we are tired of the people, the 1% of the 1%, and what they have done to the country, what they've done to the world. Government is finished. It's not going to work. I don't care who we vote for, who we put into office, they're bought and paid for before they get there. This is absolutely a revolution. Because now everybody realizes that we're slaves to debt. We're slaves to isms and schisms. We're slaves to people's ideology. We're slaves to people who are intractable in their thinking, where they believe. But you got people in this country who believe we're free and know damn well we're not. How in the hell can the Marines go to Iraq, serve two tours, and then can't come back and stand on the street in Oakland? If you can't do that, you have to have a revolt.
Welcome to the Occu Podcast, Episode 1. My name is Dennis Traynor Jr., and I will serve as your host for this, the Occu Podcast. Visit us at occupodcast.org. The episodes are free, commercial free. They are gluten free as well. They're free to download and distribute as you see fit. Since this is the first episode, I think a little bit of an explanation about what this project is all about is in order. At first, I should say that there are probably a few podcasts out there dedicated solely to covering and discussing and analyzing the Occupy movement. This project is in no way intended to displace or replace or compete with those other worthy projects. This project is just my attempt to listen to the voices that are working within the Occupy movement. And it was born out of the fact that I am now sitting down in front of my desk editing a documentary on the Occupy movement. So I've spent the better part of the last 4 months, give or take, on the road filming a documentary about the Occupy movement and sitting now in my, you know, kind of rural New England setting about 45 miles west, northwest of Boston, Massachusetts. I've been feeling a little bit disconnected since I got the field production for the documentary that I'm working on ended January 20th with that week that started Occupy the Dream, then Occupy Congress, and then Occupy the Courts. To me, that seemed like the first 4 months, a first chapter in this revolt that may become a reform, a revolutionary movement that remains to be seen. Another thing that you might want to know about me is that I started off my engagement in this movement as an organizer for what was then called October2011.org. October2011.org called for a massive occupation of Washington, D.C., and that call went out before the Adbusters call to occupy Wall Street. I'm not saying that to say we had the idea first. I'm just as a point of information that of why I guess I wasn't more engaged with Occupy Boston. I signed on as an organizer to the October 6th movement way back in April of 2011 and had told my wife and two children that I was going to spend at least the month of October occupying Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. Obviously, history has shown that that particular occupation has become but one chapter in a huge story. And that, of course, is a fantastic thing for the movement. So that's enough about me and about this project. I'm going to try to talk to a lot of different people who have their boots on the ground or are contributing to the progress and escalation of the Occupy movement as we enter into what I hope will be a massive American spring. We'll try to do these daily. We'll try to keep them under 35 or 40 minutes, nice and brief for you. And each day we'll talk to someone different. My first guest is Allie McCracken. Allie is literally a professional activist. She works with Code Pink in Washington, D.C., and she has also been very active in McPherson at McPherson Square, which was recently raided. So our conversation is going to range in topics from discussing the national debate about quote-unquote diversity of tactics in the wake of Chris Hedges' article, about the cancer in Occupy. And by the way, Chris Hedges will be a guest on this program later in the week. We'll then move on to talk about issues more specific to Occupy DC, they just being evicted and just being raided recently and kind of dealing with the hangover that that is. You know, obviously this is not a movement about occupying public space. That's not what the revolution is about. But these places are much more than symbols. And how does a group regroup after being evicted? And the saying goes, you can't evict an idea. But what is the next steps for the Occupy movement? Now that we're in our winter of discontent, how can we take a step back before we take another few steps forward, learn from our victories and our defeats, and figure out what the next steps are? So without further ado, this is the phone conversation I had earlier with Allie McCracken of Code Pink and Occupy DC.
So thank you for joining me, Allie. Allie is involved in McPherson Square in Occupy DC. And before we talk specifically about recent developments in Occupy DC, I wanted to talk a little bit about this diversity of tactics debate that's happening. And maybe it's just happening from my perspective because I'm sitting at home editing a documentary. And when I'm procrastinating from editing the documentary, I'm following the various listservs or blogs that I follow. And after Chris Hedges last week said that there was this cancer in Occupy and made some remarks about the black bloc, like it was a club, a group of people and not a tactic, a kind of major debate has sprung up about how much diversity of tactics we should embrace. And while I don't think that there are many people out there who think that we should embrace the use of tanks and armed drones, there's a certain tolerance in some circles for a more liberal definition of what nonviolence is than, say, the Martin Luther King Jr. generation. Is this diversity of tactics debate something that you're seeing happening in Occupy DC?
Well, sort of. I guess that's a really vague answer. I mean, we definitely have the discussion about what tactics are appropriate, but Occupy DC is at a point right now where we're still reeling from having our physical encampment raided last week. And even before then, but the biggest focus for us was outreach and growing our numbers. And even if we wanted to engage in some sort of diversity of tactics, there's very few of us. The direct actions that, you know, took place earlier on, we're not as, I mean, we couldn't get a more radical, I guess, just because we're still focusing on trying to reach mainstream people who would probably be turned off by the idea of a very liberal definition of nonviolence. And one thing that Occupy DC seems to agree upon as a whole, for the most part, is that it's nonviolent tactics which are going to kind of create a broad base of support, which is what we need to really move forward and work more effectively with the community around us instead of alienating those people by using aggressive tactics. But I've heard some people aren't willing to rule it out, and there are lessons that we could learn from tactics like Black Bloc in regards to like organization, because we're struggling with being really organized around our actions.
I mean, of course, a lot of this came after January 28th in Oakland, and a lot of occupations, I'm not sure if D.C. was one of them, had solidarity marches with Occupy Oakland after, you know, images of black bloc or blocks using, you know, people very creative kind of plastic shields and trying to march and take a public space and things like that. So to me, this looks like an escalation of nonviolent tactics that, to me, is inspiring, but you're making the point that maybe we're trying to widen this audience of people who might be attracted to Occupy. Go ahead.
I just want to say that in Oakland, when they peacefully assemble the occupiers, they're met with tear gas and rubber bullets and things that physically threaten their well-being. Here in D.C., the park police, up until the raid, were pretty lenient with us. They never used anything like that, so there was never any need for us to defend ourselves. So that's why I don't think that those sort of tactics have transpired over to this side of the country?
There, we did see, and that was my experience in both Washington, D.C. and you know, here where I am living about an hour outside of Boston. When I get into Boston, I've been calling it, I guess, this soft pillow approach. The police have been very patient. Even when they're raiding, you know, when you're watching those live streams of them raiding McPherson, it seems like they're willing to, you know, if it takes them 2 days to get the job done, they're willing to take 2 days. The one exception I saw someone get tased. Were you present for that?
When they got tased at the day of the raid or a couple of days before? Because it happened
before,
both days.
It was a couple of – the video that I saw was a couple of days before the raid. And you saw someone that I recognized, but whose name I don't know off the top of my head, kind of running away from the police. You don't know what happened before the video started rolling. But then two female park police officers restrained him and another tased him. And then I read that he was banned from part of the court order was that he was banned from returning to McPherson. So were you present for that?
I wasn't there, but I saw the video right away, and it's awful. Talk about excessive use of force. The guy's name is Lash. And I know that he had been tearing down the orders, you know, the no sleeping orders that were the police taped up to the tents. But as far as I know, that's the only thing that he did. I don't know the details surrounding it, but either way, it was just awful.
And then you said someone was tased during the actual eviction itself?
Yeah, that was good. That whole day was a nightmare. The police cleared out the park one quadrant at a time, and then they told us that, like, the General Assembly lawn was back open again. And so from what I heard, a man tried to go over and go into the area they said was open, and they tased him on the spot. And I didn't see – it was raining, and it was really cold, and everyone was really confused and frustrated. And so I never found out what the follow-up to that was. I think he might have been a homeless man who lived in the park, but that's what everyone was talking about the whole afternoon.
So what does McPherson look like now? The Tent of Dreams is down. Are there any tents at all remaining in the park?
There's a few. The park is really muddy now, and there's a few, like, empty tents. But we still have the library up and the info tent and I think the medical tent / food tent now, but we're not really supposed to have food. So there's a few, like, tent shells, basically. And right now the biggest concern is finding places for people to sleep.
I mean, it's hard to get some perspective when for a long time you and others have been physically occupying a space 24 hours a day. But in your opinion, how crucial is the 24-hour physical occupation of space, public space, to this movement?
Well, the encampment itself is obviously just a tactic, and it can be a huge energy suck to constantly obsess over the politics and the logistics of the camp, and that definitely was a theme I saw happening across the entire country, where people were getting bogged down with that sort of things the camp stuff, instead of focusing on the real issues. But I do think the camp was really helpful in building a really tight-knit community. Everyone who was there and everyone who joined while the camp still existed and was, I guess you could say, thriving compared to what it is now, really, we're all really close now, which is a good thing. We all trust each other, and we work well together. And camping outside reminded us every single day that we were, you know, fighting for the people, and we were trying to affect change for the people who have to sleep outside in those parks, whether or not they like it. They don't have a choice because they have nowhere else to go because they're homeless for a variety of reasons. So one thing Occupy DC is doing is working on different forms of organization in order to address the issues of, like, for example, the camp separately from the real issues. And that's one thing we're going forward with. And I guess, it would have been nice to gather more support while we had the camp itself, but now we don't have a choice, so we just need to work with what we've got.
The tents that are remaining there, that might be unusual for some people to hear. But again, the D.C. Park Police are very different. They operate very differently than maybe police forces around the country. Explain why they're allowed to stay in compliance with some law.
Well, there's a ban on camping in the park. You can have a vigil in the park, but no sleeping and no bedding material or anything that implies that you might be sleeping. So, I don't know. The police were really arbitrary about this the day that they raided us, where they said that they were just going to go through each tent and check out which ones were in compliance with the no camping law. And at the behest of Congressman Issa, who's a total jerk, richest member of Congress who ordered all this to happen. Yeah. Anyways, so they said they were going to go through each tent. They ended up just chucking most of them into like a giant dumpster, which is really awful. But then they randomly left a few empty tents around because they didn't have any bedding in them. And it's, like I said, it was very arbitrary. And they come through every night, well, most days and most nights, and check all the tents and to see that there's no bedding and to make sure that the tent flap is open.
Did Occupy DC, being one of the longest standing physical occupations in the country, and watching from afar these other occupations in other cities get shut down, did you take any lessons from those actions? And were you you were prepared? The police obviously came by and you knew days ahead of time that you're going to be evicted. Was there a contingency plan? I mean, one of the, I guess as a side note, one of the amazing things that I experienced in New York is that at Occupy Wall Street, when they were evicted, there was so much confusion about where to go afterwards, because there was actually no plan, you know, for what was going to be an inevitable action. The police were going to evict you from Zuccotti in New York, and obviously you guys knew. So, were you prepared in any way from lessons learned by watching other actions like this?
In some regards, we were prepared in the sense that we had churches set up to send people to like so they could sleep there. But obviously, that's really short-term solution. But in terms of reacting on the spot to the actual raid itself, we didn't know what to expect. And based on the behavior of the D.C. Park Police has been, like, markedly different than police all across the country. Like, like you said before, they'll take 2 days to clean the park if they need to. And they're not stupid. They know that the more force they use, the more our cause is going to grow. So when they came in and started cleaning the park out in slow motion, it was really hard for us to decide what to do. And they kept negotiating with us and they kept lying to us and saying, we're not going to throw out these tents. We're just going to check and see if they have bedding. And after really heated and complicated and frustrating deliberation, we would say, okay, they're just going to look. They're just going to look. And every time they had a different excuse, and every time it was tough because they weren't using force. And we tried to do sit-ins and we tried to block them and they would barricade us off and people weren't angry. People were just upset because everything was moving so slowly. And it was raining and it was freezing. So it's not like they ran in with their riot shields and their tear gas and we had a chance to fight back or really sit. Everything just went so slowly. But when we tried to take a stand on the last quadrant, when we finally said, look, they've been lying to us this whole day. They're just going to keep clearing this out. Their big thing was that the last stand was the library. We had about 20 people sitting in front of the library with arms linked. And they said, look, your library is in compliance. Like, there's no front door. Like, it was completely open on the front. They said, we can see everything. We know it's not a problem. We're just going to send one person in to look at it. And we said, okay. After much deliberation. And then the next thing I knew, I stood up to let someone over. And the next thing I knew, there were about 10 police caving in on me with their riot shields, shoving me into all, like, hundreds of people behind me. And then they forcibly moved us out of the last quadrant using their batons and their shields. And it totally caught us off guard because 2 seconds earlier, they had been, like, negotiating with us.
Well, even after that, it seems like there were some actions surrounding the CPAC conference recently. Were you a participant in any of those protests?
Yeah, I Yes and no. I didn't make it to the entire CPAC event, but I was a part of like the planning group. It was kind of a combination of the action.
You sound a little lukewarm about it.
I know. Well, I mean, we got evicted very recently, and everyone, I mean, after the eviction, I don't know how to describe it, and I don't mean to be so pessimistic because I feel like we do have a future and we are going to move forward, but a lot of people felt really, really burned out after this. People who had been there since October 1st to see their homes over the last several months get destroyed, a lot of people went, they get really upset, and our regular action committee, which is really fired up and creative, we kind of lost our steam around CPAC, and reading the CPAC schedule and the people who were going to be there was just literally depressing because they're just so bad. They're the worst of the worst, you know, and we had lots of meetings. We had really long meetings every night around CPAC, what the action would be, and we couldn't seem to come to an agreement, and people were dropping like flies, and every night it was a different group meeting. And so we sort of just tried to make a show out there, and we went in solidarity with the unions on Friday when Scott Walker was giving a presentation. I think we really just needed time to regroup, and everyone, all the main people from Occupy DC want to regroup and want to get bigger. But we're going to focus now less, I think this is the impression that I get, is less on actions and more on organizing and doing outreach and our working groups that are trying to do like constructive work as well as action planning. So we don't seem to have the resources right now for like big time actions. So that's why CPAC wasn't as epic as it could have been, but it was still fun to heckle Republicans going in.
I think a lot of people who had either participated in or were sympathetic to occupations that have been long since shut down are going to sympathize with this kind of hangover period that you're experiencing right now, just having recently been shut down. And, you know, I think there's also a divide maybe out there amongst occupiers. You know, I've heard some people at Occupy Wall Street say that the best thing to happen to their movement was to have the park shut down. You know, McPherson had tents and 24-hour private living spaces for a long time, wherein at Zuccotti, that the tent portion, the private space portion, was actually a relatively short amount of time, even though they were occupying Zuccotti for almost 2 months. The time when they had private spaces was a relatively short amount of time. So what McPherson and to some extent even Freedom Plaza were able to accomplish is something to build on. So looking forward then, as far as organizing, do you get a sense then, as the weather starts to get better, as the spring stretches into a summer that's going to see not one but two major political conventions, also in May, the G8 and NATO summit, do you see Occupy DC looking for, you know, building on and growing and getting bigger as we go forward?
Yes, I definitely do. I agree with you. I think I personally and the rest of us maybe are experiencing that hangover period right now. But I do think that we will move forward and we will grow. We're taking this time to hook into a lot of local community issues.
Mm-hmm.
And relate them to the broader picture, because it's interesting being in D.C. You know, you've got all the local issues plus all the national level issues because we're in the Capitol, and it's tough. But we've already talked about both conventions and the GA, and there's a lot of people already planning on going out there. And we also have recognized the need for us to be more proactive as opposed to reactive. It is nice to take a step back from the camp and reassess the way we're doing everything. And like you said, I think the weather will definitely have an impact on the way we move forward as well. I think it'll grow. We're broadening our capacity, like the sectors of the town that we're trying to hook into, and hopefully that'll bring us more numbers and more broad-based support from people who are invested in the same issues as us but might not have been able to connect with us thus far because of the camp, because they don't sleep in the camp or because they don't agree with the camp.
looking back to the beginning of October, you're talking about reassessing and what we can learn, and assuming that in Washington, D.C. and in cities around the country, there's going to be an attempt to reoccupy space. What would you do differently the next time?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, we've been talking about, I shouldn't say that. Everyone has kind of floated the idea of occupying an indoor space. Mm-hmm. To make it a little bit more pragmatic, like perhaps someone whose home is about to be foreclosed or an abandoned building. Like here in D.C., you have a great example of that is the Franklin School, which is a building occupied D.C. at one point tried to take over. It's a former homeless shelter that was shut down by the D.C. government and has been out of use for 2 years, and all the former homeless residents are out sleeping in a nearby park. So I think it would be, if we're really going to try to reoccupy space, instead of taking a public park and making everyone who walks through that park mad every day, we could take a physical space, like a building like the Franklin School, and transform it into a community-oriented center. Now, there's a lot of technical issues that come along with that I'm aware of. But I think it would be interesting to try a different approach for a start.
And then finally, I know that as a professional activist working for Code Pink, that you're actively working towards this Occupy AIPAC. Talk about the history behind that and what you expect to happen during that conference.
Sure. Great. Thank you. Well, AIPAC is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's the second most powerful lobbyist group in the United States. So very much like the big banks and corporations, AIPAC has an insane amount of influence over our government in regards to our foreign policy. So AIPAC is the primary reason that we send Israel $3 billion every single year, which adds up to that's about $8.2 million every single day, which is monetary resources that would be much better spent here in the United States, considering all the issues that we have domestically, and also not to mention the fact that Israel uses that money solely to buy weapons, which it then uses to oppress the Palestinians and act belligerently towards its neighboring Arab countries. So Occupy, every year AIPAC meets, has its annual convention with at least 10,000 people, and this year they've got over 13,000 people. Mm-hmm. And every year there are activists who protest outside, but we're really, last year and this year, we're really organizing around this because it's outrageous how much they control our government and how much of our financial resources are stolen to give to the Israeli regime. We have an entire day of speakers in an Occupy AIPAC conference on March 3rd. And then on March 4th, when AIPAC is meeting, we will be out in full force, hundreds have already signed up for the conference and the protest part, but we'll be outside protesting them. And hopefully, like last year, we had some direct actions inside where activists disrupted Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, while he was speaking. And he'll be back again this year, along with the president of Israel, Shimon Peres. So hopefully we can occupy the occupiers. I think it'll be an awesome event.
I came to the Occupy movement through my interest in solidarity with the anti-war movement and my opposition to U.S. foreign policy in general. You know, I've called it a blowback-inducing homicidal bull in a geopolitical China shop. And I've been a little bit frustrated at times in that when I talk to people at Occupy or when I attend anti-war / Occupy type of events, I get nods of agreement, I get nods of solidarity, and go get them, pal. But it's in my experience that the Occupy movement has held at least a little bit opposition to U.S. foreign policy or anti-war kind of movements in general at a slight arm's reach. Some of that may be because a lot of these anti-war groups are of an older kind of a structure. They don't operate in this kind of horizontal consensus-building decision-making process. But I think it actually goes much deeper than that. Can you talk to some of the challenges that you face organizing an Occupy event that's basically that's the third rail in foreign policy, which is in and of itself the third rail. So a third rail within the third rail is something that's anti-Israel, but more broadly just anti-American foreign policy, and getting support from the Occupy movement to participate in that kind of a thing.
It's a complicated subject. Yeah, as someone who spent the last year learning, like, I guess you could say the older way of organizing, it's really interesting to incorporate this new organic style of organizing that Occupy displays with, like, the skills that I picked up from working with CodeBank and working, you know, in conjunction with a lot of other anti-war groups. And I think that both sides, that's a polarizing, but people from both backgrounds need to be more open-minded to each other. Mm-hmm. Definitely the anti-war organizers who have been doing this since Vietnam, they have the experience that some of the young people at Occupy definitely could use, for sure, especially in organizing. But that comes at running the risk of just standing up. I mean, from what the old model, which is mostly, I'm not bashing it in any way because I do this constantly, but standing outside somewhere holding a sign and chanting. And
right.
That doesn't give much credit to the older movement, but it's true. The young people are trying to move beyond that and get a little bit more creative and cause more of a ruckus and across the entire country. So I think what I've been trying to do to tie in foreign policy, which is sometimes contentious, or especially around the issue of Israel, is by pointing out, like, how our financial resources could be where they're actually going. And instead of, like, we're always talking about the bailouts, bailing out the banks, but what about the weapons manufacturers who are getting just as much of our tax dollars to go in and murder people, like, halfway across the world? And I received mixed responses from Occupy, but I think that D.C. is an anomaly because you have a lot of people here who are involved in the existing party system. Like, I don't know. I don't want to call anyone out on being a Democratic operative, but it's definitely undeniable that there are people who are Democrats here who are trying to get other Democrats elected, and the wars are, benefiting them. Their campaign contributors are weapons manufacturers, and so it's tough. It's tough, but people are starting to make the connection, and the issue of Israel and Palestine is actually coming up in Occupy DC more than it ever has before, and I'm working on putting together a group to bring Occupy APAC to the General Assembly and the Action Committee, especially because lately, I know I'm kind of jumping around here, but I have so much to say, especially because lately Israel, that the rhetoric between Israel and APAC itself has really been that it's time to attack Iran, and if, you know, the United States should do it before Israel, so Israel doesn't look bad, and I don't think even the most moderate person wants us to go into another war. At least that's what I hope.
Although polls show that, the same policies enacted by Obama, enacted by Bush when enacted by Obama, are supported by people on the left. And you mentioned Democratic operatives, and we don't have to go too much into this, and I wasn't gonna touch this at all, but since you bring it up, D.C. is, you know, everyone has a job in D.C., you know. In Boston,
right.
And New York, they have jobs. So some of the people who have jobs in D.C. are going to be with organizations that have affiliations with the Democratic Party, and some of those organizations, their sole job is to get Democrats elected. And then some of those individuals, after work, may be part of the Occupy D.C. or Freedom Plaza or whatever. Is it a concern talked about? I mean, I don't want to say the word co-option, but that there could be people within the Occupy movement who are going to shift away from what is, I think, broadly consensus that the Occupy movement is nonpartisan. It's not about politicians or parties, but in some way try to help the Democratic Party come as we enter into this election season.
Yeah, that's always on the radar, and I think that's what makes D.C., from what I've heard, really different from the other occupied, because they don't all have to. It's pretty safe to assume that everyone here has some sort of political agenda, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. And at one point, a couple months ago, it was a big issue. But I've noticed that since some people in particular who have been quick to point fingers and make accusations have sort of disconnected from the movement, that we've kind of come together again without the pre-existing paranoia, and are trying to figure out how to work with those people. And after, it's funny, I know a few self-proclaimed Democrats, proud Democrats, who after the raid were radicalized and thought, wow, which is cool. So I think what I've learned is, although there is that possibility of co-option, it's not, you shouldn't rule out people who have the potential to move past that partisan affiliation that we're so against in the Occupy movement.
Can we co-op them?
I think we are.
All right, we'll leave it there. Allie McCracken from Occupy DC and Code Pink, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Dennis.
That was the first edition of the OccuPodcast. Thank you for listening. Go to OccuPodcast.org for more, where you can find links to follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Tell your friends, tell your enemies. This is a new show, and it's only going to grow by you sharing it with your friends and a couple of your enemies. I'm going to let the Second Line Band take you out. This is Which Side Are You On? The 99% remix, recorded at Occupy Boston, December 8th, 2011. Peace. I'm gonna go to the hospital.